Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hello, Chris. Good to talk again. I'm coming live from Portlaoise today. I seem to be traveling all over the country at the moment. And unfortunately, I was on the road this week when you had your podcast with Professor Edgar Morganrath on the Irish Reunification Report. I listened to it on the way down to Portlaoise this morning. Really interesting stuff. So, you know, it's an incredibly complex, uncertain topic, whatever adjective you want to use. There's just so much unknown here. Listening to it, it was funny when the report was published, there was a lot of blowback, as you might expect, about the basis on which the calculations and the costs were calculated. And, you know, one of the criticisms was that it was based on a static situation and that it didn't build in the possibility that Northern Ireland would grow and that things there would get better and reducing the cost. So that's all really interesting. But I do think one thing the report did actually do in a very good way was to put some data and information out there. And as you said to Edgar in the podcast, this sort of data analysis and data provision was something that was sadly lacking in the whole Brexit debate. So I think it's good to get it out there to start a conversation. There is a long way to go. One of the things that I guess I find really difficult to reconcile in my own mind is, you know, the possibility of this happening in any reasonable time frame, because I'm just not convinced at this stage that people in the north, or particularly in the south, would actually vote for unification at this juncture. I could be wrong on that, but it strikes me that if the a million unionists are to be taken into this country or thereabouts in a united Ireland, surely there will have to be some acceptance of Britishness, you know, to respect some of the traditions of the Unionist Party. And I'm just not convinced down here that there would be any popular acceptance of that sort of concept. So I, you know, quite frankly, cannot see unification happening in any reasonable time frame. And actually, I wouldn't like to see it happening at the moment. I just think there is too much up in the air. I think it's too difficult. I think it would be incredibly difficult to reconcile both communities. Well, you're talking about three communities, effectively.
Yeah. It was a 50-minute conversation, which I intended to make only 30 minutes. And I felt that although we delved into the issues, I think in a very appropriate and reasoned manner, he would say that, wouldn't he? We left a little bit on the table, and it risked a conversation between two economists becoming a little bit geeky at times. But it was a magnificent conversation, and I just want to repeat my thanks to Edgar for partaking. In a way, it was a bit odd because it was two economists, one with a very British accent, one with a curious combination of German and Monaghan, I think, in his accent, talking about Irish reunification. But our credentials are A, as economists, and B, between us, we have 70 years of having lived in Ireland. Edgar is still there, of course, and I am here in the UK. It was a fabulous conversation, and I would urge anybody interested in the issues to have a listen, because I think we did discuss it in an open and constructively critical way. Reunification, of course, is a topic that has global resonance. This week, we've had the ex-president of Taiwan visiting mainland China. That's something that doesn't happen very often. And Xi Jinping, the president of mainland China, if I can call it that, repeating his calls for the reunification, peaceful, we hope, of, if it were to happen at all, that same caveat, between China and Taiwan. But if I can just, for a second, summarize what I consider to be the most salient points. They may not have come out as emphatically as I would have liked during that 50-minute conversation, is that somebody is going to have to pay. And we can argue about the quantum, but we do know that it's going to be a lot of money. And the key assumption is going to revolve around equalization of things like civil service salaries, pensions, and the benefit system, when those things in the north are equalized with those things in the republic. That's when the costs will really kick in. If you assumed an overnight equalization of all of those things between the republic and the north, that's where that 20 billion figure for many, many years, 20 billion sterling, comes in. If you do not equalize pensions, benefits, and civil service salaries, public sector salaries overnight, then that figure falls to about 10 billion sterling a year. So that's parameterizing it. Either way, it's an awful lot of money that somebody is going to have to pay. The second thing that I would emphasize, that I don't think an awful lot of people know this, or at least they don't realize it to the precise level of detail that Edgar stressed, which is that the deficit and debt situation in the North is akin to twice as bad as Greece's deficit situation when it was at the peak of its financial crisis 15 or so years ago and ended up defaulting on its debt. It's in a severe fiscal situation. Somebody is going to have to pick up the tab should there be reunification.
Chris, can I stop you and ask you, and this is probably demonstrating my ignorance, this debt is, if Northern Ireland were a separate entity, and is UK national debt actually broken down by the four constituent parts of the United Kingdom?
No, there would have to be a negotiation, and that's, I'll come on to that in a second.
Okay.
And there we think that it'll be something like per capita. They'll just simply take the total stock of debt and allocate it to on a per capita basis. Is one way, an obvious way of doing it. And the reason why the authors of this report and me think that that the Republic will have to take some debt on, if not the whole debt accruing on a per capita basis to the North, is because of precedent. And you can go back to the 1860s when the state of Virginia in the United States broke up. There was a debt settlement there that involved sharing. When Ireland broke from the UK in 1922. Ireland took on some of the UK's debts at that time. When Scotland was thinking about leaving back in the earlier part of this decade, it was accepted by all parties that Scotland, if it did vote for separation from the United Kingdom, that it would take part of the debt. When the Soviet Union broke up, there were debt-sharing arrangements. When Czechoslovakia broke up, there were debt-sharing arrangements. So the global precedent, including the Irish precedent, is for debt sharing. And that's one of the assumptions that other authors have challenged, that people say that all you've got to do is be a tough negotiator with the UK. And some people have said that's equivalent to Irish negotiators saying to the British, give us Northern Ireland and leave your wallet behind. And I think that that's an interesting negotiating tactic. But that raises the subject of negotiating principles. I was once sent by somebody that used to employ us, Jim. His name is Tony, to a negotiating skills course at the INSEAD Business School in Fontainebleau in France decades ago. And I remember from that negotiation skills course is that one of the key things that you need to realize when you are in a negotiator, if you want to be an effective negotiator, is that you need a walk-away price. You need a point at which you will get up from the table and storm off. The problem with the negotiations that could take place in the event of Irish unification is it's likely that they will only happen, people will only sit down at the table to talk about money after the successful referendum on Irish unification has taken place. So the Irish government at that negotiating table will be committed to taking the North after that referendum, one presumes, and therefore hasn't got a walkaway price. And the British will know this. The only hope from a negotiating skills point of view, and this was a point made by Edgar, I'm not sure whether it was on the pod or when he was chatting to me afterwards, was that if you looked at the negotiating skills of the British during the Brexit referendum, you'd have some hope that the Irish will be an awful lot more better prepared than the British will be. So negotiating skills are going to be incredibly important. But I do think that in principle, the Irish government is potentially going to be in a very, very weak position. So somebody's going to have to pay a lot of money is the bottom line. We can argue about how much, but it's going to be a lot. And how much the Irish taxpayer pays, because at the moment, the London taxpayer pays for the North, and the negotiations will be how much the Dublin and Cork taxpayer is going to have to pay for the North. And we can argue about the actual quantum, but it's going to be many billions, and it's going to be down to the negotiating skills of the people at the table over who pays for what. Your point about growth is absolutely fascinating and on the money, Jim, because static is the right way to describe it. But again, there's an awful lot of evidence for this, because what we're talking about here is, in the wider context, regional development. And how do you get poorer regions of any economy to start growing again, to become as productive as the richer areas? How do you get the North to be as productive as the rest of the Republic? And you know how difficult that is. And the UK knows how difficult that is. And Edgar admits and acknowledges that it is possible that a new development model for the North could come along. That all of the historical experience of regional development is that one of two things will happen. You will try it and fail, as they have done with Wales in the UK, in the northeast of England, and they haven't got there yet in Germany, which is something we talked about a lot. 30 plus years later, East Germany is still nowhere near as productive as West Germany. It's made a journey. It's gotten better, absolutely, but it isn't there yet. And so that's the second point, is that even if you do succeed, it could take decades for you to achieve the elimination of the fiscal deficit of the North, which is the same thing as saying you've got to get it to be as productive as the South. Mm.
Okay. I'm sure it's a subject we will return to, Chris. I want to talk a little bit about some developments on the interest rate front. But first, I guess I want to acknowledge, or sorry, I want you to acknowledge that the UK economy officially came out of recession in January and February of this year. We saw GDP growth in January of 0.3%, GDP growth in February of 0.1%. So the UK economy is back in growth mode, Chris, coming off a low base, but it's back in growth mode.
May I interject slightly, which is that we're talking about 0.2, I think it was, or maybe it was 0.3 in January, and 0.1 in the subsequent month. And the UK economy is still smaller than it was a year ago, but it has grown for 2 months. So I don't know whether you're doing a victory lap there, Jim, cracking open the champagne. But I still say the UK economy, yes, it is showing some signs of stabilizing around a very, very low growth rate. But in anticipation of what you're about to say about the United States, the UK is caught up in this global thing caused by the States principally, where the hoped for growth boost from lower interest rates isn't going to happen, is it, Jim?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
No, it's not. No. And before I get onto that, yesterday I came across a headline front page from the Daily Express in 2016. Cheaper food after EU exit. Experts now say that prices will come down. Okay, yeah. That was the Daily Express in 2016. There was a headline in the Daily Express this week, front page, a staggering 16.7% rise in food prices. So maybe Michael Gove was correct that we shouldn't be listening to the experts, but that just demonstrates clearly the whole nonsense of Brexit. And that was something that certainly struck me from your conversation with Edgar Morgenroth, you know, about the need to have sort of proper debate and detailed discussion on these issues before you jump into something that's so politically motivated. On the interest rate front, the European Central Bank left rates unchanged this week as expected. But apparently it took around five members of the ECB's governing council to come around to the view that rates should be left unchanged. You know, they had a bias towards actually cutting rates. So it would certainly suggest that the beginning of the ECB rate loosening cycle will commence from June onwards. Obviously, in a 2 or 3 month period, less than that at this stage, actually, things could change a little bit. But it certainly would appear that for borrowers here, the news is going to get a little bit better. The US situation is still shrouded in contradictions, in doubt. We've had a mild disagreement on where US rates might go later this year. I was of the view that rates would be cut. You're of the view that they probably wouldn't be cut. And last Friday, after we recorded last week's podcast, it was in anticipation of the US employment report, which came out once again very, very strong. So the US labor market's still showing a lot of momentum. The minutes of the Federal Reserve's meeting in March showed that a number of members of the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, were expressing deep concerns about the general rise in inflation, but they still believed that rates would come down later this year. On Thursday night, a Fed member, Susan Collins, she said that recent data eased concerns about an imminent need to adjust interest rates, but she still expects cuts to begin later this year. I don't know where I am on this at this stage. You know, certainly the evidence is not in my favor, but yet a lot of the narrative from many Fed members is still very much of the view that while they won't be cutting rates now, they will be cut later this year. In terms of my credibility, I hope they deliver one before the end of December.
Well, Jim, I'm not going to do a victory lap like you with your views about the UK, even though I was right about the interest rate outlook in the States.
Hold on, Chris. Hold on a second. There's still 7 months or 8 months to go, okay?
And that's the point. That's a very good point, is that we're only in April now, and things have changed so dramatically since the beginning of the year with respect to interest rate cuts. At the beginning of January, which wasn't that long ago, markets were pricing in maybe 6 or 7 interest rate cuts in the United States. Now they're having doubts about whether there will be 2. Definitely 1 is what the markets are saying, and maybe a second, and that's it. So we've had a really, really dramatic change. Now, for those of us that are financial and economic geeks, that's very interesting in and of itself. But some of our listeners might be wondering why that has such a why that's so interesting for us in the UK and Ireland. And the fact is, we go back to that thing that we say all the time, everything is connected to everything else. And that falling away of interest rate cut expectations in the States has had a similar, slightly lesser impact on Europe and the UK, so that there are now far fewer interest rate cuts priced in Ireland and in the UK as well, because principally what happens in the United States connects to their bond market, which connects to our bond market, longer-term interest rates. All those connections in financial markets are very, very important. They're not perfect. They're not one for one, but everything is linked to everything else. And now the talk is that the ECB is going to be the first to go. And I think that you and I would probably agree about that. Would you, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. There's no doubt about it. And you'd have to believe, although it's not happening, that it seems inevitable that the dollar is going to get a lot stronger at some point.
Well, parity is now the talk of the foreign exchange markets. One for one against the euro and the dollar is on the cards. Whether that's true or not, you and I both know what it's like forecasting exchange rates, let alone anything else. But we've both been dollar bulls, optimistic about the dollar's prospects for quite some time. And of course, the interesting aspect about that is that, of course, exchange rates are very important to anybody involved in trade, anybody going on holiday. Exchange rates are incredibly important. Anybody buying stuff from overseas that's dollar denominated, our oil, for example, is every time the dollar goes up, even though the dollar price of a barrel of oil might stay the same, and of course it's not, it's been going up lately, that makes the euro and the pound cost of a gallon of petrol more expensive. So again, this is something that one thing here, the exchange rate, affects an awful lot of other things. And the weaker euro that might happen in the way that we suggest it will could do a lot of the work that the ECB wants in terms of relaxing of monetary conditions. And that if the dollar-euro rate was to go down 10%, that's the equivalent in terms of its expansionary effect and inflationary effect, if you like, on the euro area as a big cut in interest rates. So again, that might be a reason for thinking that Irish and UK mortgage rates may not be coming down quite as fast as we previously thought because of currency weakness.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the transmission mechanism is very different. I just think it would take a massive fall in the value of the euro to change the ECB's interest rate stance. So I will stand by my line that I believe for Irish mortgage holders and borrowers generally, the news is going to start getting better, not least because we're about to see a technical adjustment in the ECB's interest rate, which will see tracker mortgages come down by 0.35%.
I think we have a trifecta of disagreement, Jim.
We have actually.
We have the UK economy, US interest rates, and now the monetary consequences, the interest rate consequences of the euro-dollar exchange rate. It's down again, the euro, by nearly 1% today against the dollar. So that's an easing of monetary conditions in Europe. So let's see.
At the moment,
I feel that I'm two for two. So maybe you'll get this one.
As I said in my introduction today, I've been on the road a lot over the last few weeks, talking at various events. I'm in Port Leash today, talking to a lot of people involved in the steel industry. In Dublin, Port Marnock specifically, yesterday morning, I was speaking at an event with a group of business leaders. And the reason why I never turn down a speaking gig is because, you know, one learns so much about what's happening on the ground in the economy in different sectors. It's invaluable stuff, to be honest. And we've spoken so many times since we began this podcast about the difficulty in interpreting what's really happening in the Irish economy, you know, the issues around the reliability and distortions in the GDP measure, even the gross national income STAR measure or modified domestic demand, all of those measures, they all have their flaws. And it's difficult, actually, I think, to really understand what's happening on the ground unless you look at it sector by sector. But the group of business leaders I spoke to yesterday, smaller businesses generally, in many diverse areas of activity, they were actually expressing an amazing level of negativity about business conditions on the ground. Okay, and I want to explore that. because I went away last night and just did a little bit of research just to see, you know, how real are the concerns these people are talking about. And before I do that, I think it is worth noting that the Irish inflation rate in March fell to 2.9% from 3.4% in February. So Irish inflation is now...
So, Jim, this is the CPI, not the harmonised.
That's the CPI, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
we have many different measures of inflation, don't we?
The harmonised is slightly lower than that. But so the CPI, 2.9%, were rapidly moving towards the 2% level. Well, maybe not rapidly enough, but we are steadily moving towards the 2%. I would say that excluding food and energy, inflation is still running at 4.1%. So the decline in food and energy prices in the last 12 months have certainly brought down the year-on-year rates. But, you know, having said that, with global oil prices higher, I mean, Brent crude is over $90 a barrel at the moment. The what I would describe as the ongoing death of Ukraine, you know, it's quite clear, I think, that the Russians are really gaining the upper hand in that war, is having an impact on energy markets again. So, and that's reflected, of course, that during March, petrol prices here were up during the month 1.1%, diesel was up by 0.8%. So it's not going to be plain sailing, but moving in the right direction. But this brings me back to those business leaders and the sort of message I was getting by and large. Two things. One is the elevated cost of doing business. And secondly, the basic resistance from stretched consumers and the ability to pass on higher prices is seriously restricted. So thinking about those two issues in terms of the cost of doing business, you know, it's clear that labor cost and availability is a big issue. Wages are certainly under pressure. And then, of course, we've had all of the state-induced increase in labor costs, which some of which have been introduced, others which are going to be introduced unless the new Taoiseach has a bit of a U-turn on these policies. But we're looking at the minimum wage increase of 12.4% in January, just gone. The move towards a living wage, which by 2026, which would equate to €15 per hour. And of course, when the minimum wage increases, all other wages up the line because of relativities tend to increase. PRSI rates for employers going up. We have the likelihood, and I wouldn't say the certainty because this has been a moving feast for many years now, but the likelihood that we will see auto enrollment in the pension system later this year or early next year, which effectively would represent an increase in the cost of doing business. We're seeing proposed changes to sick pay legislation and so on. So, and energy costs, all of these things are definitely feeding into the cost of doing business, particularly for the SME sector. But then you look at the consumer sector. You've heard me throwing out all of these lovely aggregate statistics about an unemployment rate of 4.3%, effectively full employment, a 2.7 million level of employment, the highest ever, tax revenues still growing strongly, you know, 83 billion last year, up 1.8% in the first quarter of this year. So all of these indicators are suggesting in the aggregate, things are going very, very well in the economy. But then I talked to these businesses who say that business conditions are really, really challenging. And as I said, apart from the cost of doing business, the other one is the resistance from consumers, the search for value and so on. And I was just looking at the cost of living pressures on consumers, because despite the fact that the headline inflation rate is coming down, you know, we've still seen a remarkable escalation in the cost of living. And just to throw a few stats at you and our listeners, Chris, between January 21 and March of this year, average consumer prices increased by 19.6%. Food prices up 20.7%, health insurance up by 16%, mortgage costs up by 77%, private rents 27.5%, electricity up by 55.7%. Eating out up by 17%. I could go on, you know, but it is quite clear that we as consumers have seen a pretty remarkable increase in the cost of living over the last 3 years. And of course, that is feeding through into the behavior of consumers. You know, they're financially stretched. They are looking for value and so on. So it really is, I think, important to understand, particularly from the perspective of policymakers, and more particularly from the perspective of the new Taoiseach who took office in the past week, about the realities of business on the ground in the economy, particularly for the SME sector. So I think if the new Taoiseach is to live up to his promises about being sort of pro-business, particularly pro-small business, I think there needs to be a strong recognition and reaction to those sorts of business pressures.
Yeah, we hear a lot from various sources, not just the ones that you've been talking to in recent days, Jim. People from representative bodies, from people just who are an SME, telling us about the cost side of things, but also the regulatory burden that is placed on them. And certainly, if you have enough anecdotes, you eventually get to data. But we certainly have a lot of anecdotes.
Yeah.
Okay, Jim, I don't know whether you've got anything left on your agenda that you want to talk about today.
No, that's pretty much it, Chris. I actually look forward to crossing swords with you on the UK, US interest rates and the European Central Bank. Okay.
The trifecta of disagreement.
Do have a great weekend, okay?
And you, buddy. Take it easy.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.